Hello there. Today is Thursday, November 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Vice President Pence consoles survivors and families of Sunday's shooting rampage.
Karen and I come to this place with a heavy heart.
President Trump now in China, where he'll press for action against North Korea. Several elections seem to send a strong message to President Trump.
People are coming to terms with the fact that, you know, I don't like the direction the country is headed right now.
Also ahead, the iPhone X is out, but it won't come cheap. It's all on today's International Edition, where we begin with President Trump holding a bilateral meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping today, where he's expected to press Xi to push North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. Trump arrived in Beijing Wednesday after addressing the South Korean National Assembly in Seoul. Joining us now is former U.S. Ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thank you for being with us. So what is your take on the trip so far and his speech in particular?
My overall impression is that so far, the parts are greater than the sum. That is to say, the overall impression I have is that he has a series of discrete issues he's working on. And among those issues, we can discuss whether he's been clear or whether he's been consistent, and whether or not this reflects the fact that maybe when he's reading a prepared speech or when he's speaking off the cuff, he has different kinds of answers. If we go back to what are the details, what are the parts of what he's talking about that don't always add up to an overall strategy.
Mm-hmm.
He first comes in, let's take what he's been saying about North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it's not too late for Kim Jong-un to come to the table. He seems to be softening his tone. He seems to be saying, quite in contradiction to the previous statements, like, you know, you're wasting your time, Rex. He seems to be saying they can come to the table.
Mm-hmm.
It can be explained by saying, by being tough, we have made it possible for this guy to come to the table. I don't know. Or, do we just want him to come to the table to agree to our demands? It's very unclear to me. But then when he's speaking from the podium and he says that, you know, do not underestimate us, do not make a mistake, North Korea, we have a lot of resolve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a prepared speech that he's giving for an audience mm-hmm. of South Koreans who he's trying to buck up.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine it's also a prepared speech that came from the foreign policy apparatus of the White House at the National Security Council. It's not off the cuff. So what I see on that specific issue of how to deal with North Korea is that it's very unclear to me, and if I were the North Koreans, I would not know whether what he is saying is, don't screw with us, don't mess with us, or what he's saying is, I'm now ready to talk. I don't know what message comes out.
Are you basically saying that you're left a little bit confused as to where we stand?
Yes.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that I see that there are other different impulses. One is to be strong and to shore up the commitment of, say, Japanese and South Korean allies. And one is to say, I'm ready to talk when he's ready. And I don't know whether those are consistent. It seems to me that on the one hand, he'll say, behave or else. People who have underestimated us in the past have been sorry. But then he says, we're ready to talk.
So do you feel like there is no clear strategy at this point with how we're dealing with North Korea?
My guess is that there are a number of people who have a number of different approaches, and we are trying to do more than one thing at once.
Certainly some of the comments regarding past administrations that he noted in his speech about how things are different now. What did that mean?
I don't know, but I guess what he is trying to say is that there have been any number of efforts from the early 90s all the way through the Bush administration, through Obama, to try to bring the North Koreans to the table. And Trump has in the past described these as giving in to the North Koreans. Everyone's kind of given to the North Koreans, and the North Koreans have simply pocketed that goodwill and taken that goodwill and not changed and have moved ahead on nuclear weapons.
The president said, we will not tolerate nuclear North Korea, but they're saying they'll never give up their program, particularly now when they feel even more threatened. So how can this ever be resolved?
A good question. I think that it would have to be that on the United States side, there is a debate among people, among experts in the United States, about whether one has to cope with a nuclear North Korea, whether one has to contain a nuclear North Korea, or whether one has to prevent a nuclear North Korea from being able to attack the United States and its allies, mm-hmm. or whether a nuclear North Korea as such is simply intolerable. These are very different positions, and I don't know that it's all been worked out. This is a very difficult problem that many administrations have struggled with, so I'm not trying to say there's an easy answer that he's not getting. But it doesn't seem that there is a clear answer from this administration any more than from any previous ones.
What about now that the president is in China? How much cooperation do you think he'll be able to get, more than we've already received? And
there will be, I think, on the Chinese side, I would imagine, an attempt to try to come across as being receptive to the president. You know, you've got a guest, you're rolling out the red carpet for him. They will, I think, mm-hmm. they will say, yes, we agree that this is an issue and that we would have to work together on it, kind of in the spirit of Mar-a-Lago or something like mm-hmm. that. What that actually adds up to in terms of both commitment and in terms of action remains to be seen. I think the thing that the Trump administration would like to see is something close to, you know, either a complete or a serious embargo on oil, something that in the mind of the Trump administration would bring North Korea to its knees. That is what China has always said. We don't want to bring North Korea to its knees. We don't want to cause North Korea to implode because then it's a problem on our border.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, can the Chinese offer something that seems to be forward-leaning and seems to be actually making a difference in being tough against the North Koreans, but not go so far as they don't want to go, which is to put the North Koreans in danger of really having a collapse.
All right. We appreciate your perspective, as always. That's former U.S. Ambassador Cameron Munter. The talks between Trump and Xi will also deal with trade, a touchy subject since Trump has long complained about the trade deficit between China and the United States. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The vice president meets with Texas church massacre victims. Saudi Arabia steps up its military operation in Yemen and a media campaign against Iran. A government report finds that a Republican tax plan would add $1.7 trillion to the national debt. And the Trump administration is limiting Americans' travel to Cuba. Find expanded coverage of these story and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife Karen are in the small town of Sutherland Springs, Texas, consoling the wounded survivors and families of the victims of the nation's latest mass murder.
President Trump asked us to be here to say to the members of the First Baptist Church and to Sutherland Springs, we are with you. The American people are with you. And as the president said on Sunday, halfway across the world, we will never leave your side.
Well, before going to Sutherland Springs, Pence comforted 10 of the critically wounded survivors being treated in San Antonio, Texas.
We just met earlier with several members of this church who are recovering from injuries at Brooke Army Medical Center. And we were deeply moved by their faith and their resilience.
He'll also meet with law enforcement officials and the church neighbor who shot the gunman as he fled, potentially saving other lives. Well, President Donald Trump suffered the sharpest political setback of his presidency on Tuesday when Democrats swept to easy victories in governor's races in the states of Virginia and New Jersey. Joining us now to talk more about it is political analyst James Goodnow. So, James, it wasn't a presidential election, but Wednesday did also mark the one-year anniversary of Donald Trump's presidential election win. So do Tuesday's election results reflect a referendum on him? Was he on the ballot even though he wasn't on the ballot?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it when you look at the clean sweep that Democrats had, when you look at what voters said in the exit polls, that this was about Donald Trump and the policies he's advanced and what he represents. I think for the first year, what you saw is people either willing to tolerate or in some cases embrace Donald Trump's rhetoric with the hope that you would have legislative wins, you would have policy wins that would come along with it. So for some, maybe they're enthused by that. For others, they'll say, I'll put up with it. But what's happened is there have been no policy wins. There have been no legislative wins. We see tax reform stumbling now. Obviously, health care has been a complete debacle. So when you see the types of numbers that we saw in Virginia, with Ralph Northam winning 54% to 45, absolute domination, it suggests that there's something deeper going on.
What do you think that something deeper is? And you mentioned exit polls. Explain what those showed.
What's going on here is people are coming to terms with the fact that, you know, I don't like the direction the country is headed right now. We're divided. It's polarized. Right now, if you look at Donald Trump's approval ratings, they're at historic lows in the mid-30s. And so you saw both in Virginia and in New Jersey that Donald Trump was moving the needle in a negative way. He was on the minds of voters. It came up in questions that they asked, did Donald Trump play a role in the vote? And even though it may not have been in a majority, it was very close to a majority of voters. And that can obviously have a significant impact. And we see that playing out when you're looking at races that are really won and lost on the margins here. I think more difficult to draw conclusions from New Jersey. I do think you see the same themes that were evident. But given Chris Christie's unbelievably low approval ratings in the mid to low teens, very difficult there for Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno to distance herself from Chris Christie. So she was working not only against Donald Trump, but she was working against her former boss.
Do you think that this casts some pretty fresh doubt on the health of the Republican majorities in the House and Senate? And how worried do you think Republicans are coming up for next year's midterm elections?
I think they're terrified. And if they're not terrified, they should be. Look, this is a small sampling, but we didn't just see it in the governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. We saw it across the board, even in the state local races, where you had big Democratic wins. So what this says is if I'm a Republican candidate who's a moderate, who is well-qualified thinking about running, maybe I don't want to do that. Or if I'm a donor and I'm thinking about giving to Republicans and trying to get them in the close races to squeak out a win, maybe I hold on to my money because it may be not going to a good cause. All of this is bad for Republicans. It means you're not going to get the talent you need to win, and it means you're not going to get the dollars you need. Now, the Republican Party has done a very good job of continuing to turn out the bucks, even in the face of Donald Trump. And I would expect that machine to keep running. But this is certainly a blow, and it certainly does seem to be an indicator of what may be coming down the pike. How big that is, don't know. Will it be enough to shift the balance of power in the House or the Senate? Don't know. But if I'm a Republican strategist, I am definitely worried.
And shifting just a bit, it was also a historic election for some other reason. There were a lot of historic firsts for minorities and women and members of the LGBT community.
Absolutely. So you saw some big wins for diverse candidates. And I think this is a continuation of the rejection of what Trump stands for. I think if you ask a lot of people, Donald Trump stands for an America that looks much like it did 50 years ago. At least that is the perception of many. And some embrace that. But when you see in Virginia, Danica Rome, first openly transgendered person to win in the state house. You see in Minneapolis, Andrea Jenkins, first openly trans woman of color to win. New Jersey, first Sikh mayor in Hoboken that was elected. You really see an embracing of diversity. So I think this means that for those, at least who oppose Trump and what he stands for and what has been pushed as an agenda through the travel ban and other similar policy initiatives, I think they're feeling good about this. Will that trend continue? Difficult to say. A year is a long time from now, and obviously when you go fast forward even to 2020, even longer. But I do think we're seeing the pendulum swinging back, and these are the first signs of a break point.
All right. Political analyst James Goodnow, thanks so much, as always, for your observations. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, Apple this week released the highly anticipated iPhone X with its lush screen and a big price tag that really breaks ground for the tech giant's marquee product line. Joining us now to talk about what all the hype is, technology reporter Chris Morris. So, Chris, $1,000 for a phone. Why? What makes it worth all that?
This phone's $1,000 for the same reason that your brand new TV is going to cost you a couple thousand dollars. It's new. It's the new hot thing, and you can always charge a premium for that. And that's true not just in the smartphone industry, but in any industry that's technology related. If it's new, if it's shiny, there's going to be a higher price tag on it.
Okay, but $1,000 for a phone? What does it do? Clean your house?
Well, no, but you have new emoji, and you know that's a big thing.
New emojis for $1,000.
It's a phone.
I'm just trying to understand
what it comes
this.
Down to. But it does have a few new things that the other phones don't, and that Apple is hoping will become standard as it moves into other generations.
Like what?
The camera system that it's on, it's a much better camera system both for taking pictures of other people and selfies, because you know selfies are very important to a lot of people, especially when it comes to their cell phones. It has Face ID, so instead of having to type in passcode to get in or use your fingerprint, it can just look at you and know who you are and then unlock the phone. So it's a good security measure, and it's something that you can actually get into your phone faster than you can these days.
Okay. Do you think it'll be successful?
There are some supply constraints with the iPhone X. So it's going to be a little bit harder to get that this year than maybe some people think. Now, that said, what you're seeing is a lot of people, when the iPhone 8 came out, kind of bided their time. They wanted to see the iPhone X in the store. They wanted to get their hands on it and then make the decision, do I want to pay a few hundred extra dollars for this phone that's going to have perhaps a longer life or a longer life expectancy because you future-proofed yourself?
Do you think people will spend the money and buy a phone that expensive?
I think they will, because phones are status symbols these days. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. And if you have the iPhone X, you're going to be that cool person in your crowd. Also, I don't think retailers are necessarily going to keep that $1,000 price. Now, you may pay that for the phone itself, mm-hmm. but there are going to be some incentives, especially as you get into the holiday season. Now, Sam's Club, for example, is going to have a one-day event on November mm-hmm. 11th. It's going to offer a $250 in-store credit, and it's going to waive the activation fee for anybody who buys an iPhone X. So right there, you're getting about $300 in value. That brings it down to close to $700. And all of a sudden, you know, for a cell phone, that's not quite as ridiculous as $1,000 might seem.
All right. Thanks so much, technology reporter Chris Morris. Turning now to our social media segment, we are joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Andrew, some huge changes to Twitter.
Indeed, a very big change on Twitter after they announced last month that they were going to expand to 280 characters and roll that out slowly. It has now rolled out for everyone. So
wow.
Everybody can tweet in 280 characters, although actually not everyone, because if you mm-hmm. tweet in English, Spanish, French, Portuguese, any mm-hmm. of those languages mm-hmm. that use the Roman alphabet, you can tweet with 280 characters. If you tweet in a language like Korean or Japanese or Chinese, you are still limited to 140 characters. That's because those languages, you do not need as many characters to get your message across. So Twitter said they are not expanding the totals, at least not now, for those languages. But this has been something hotly debated on Twitter. Some people love it. They're writing whole diatribes that are 280 characters long. Some people hate it. They say that it gets away from the original reason why
right.
Twitter was
just
140 characters. quick little message. Yeah. And it started with SMS messages. It was SMS text messages were 160 mm-hmm, characters mm-hmm. maximum. So Twitter said, let's make ours 140 and then 20 characters for your username. Hmm. So people are saying it gets away from the origins of Twitter. And then there are the people who are just having fun with it. I've seen people just write words over and over and over again just to get to that character limit. One of my favorites is somebody had 280 digits of pi, 3.14159265, and on.
Okay.
So people are having a lot of fun with this expanded character limit. It is going to be something that's going to take adjusting, and I think eventually people will get on board, even the naysayers.
Anything else going on?
So yesterday we talked about the singer Sia and how she posted that nude photo that a paparazzi was going to release and kind of jumped ahead of him to take that power away from him. Well, that's not the only social media story making news with the nude photos. Facebook actually wants you to send them nude photos.
What?
So this is, that's the headline that I saw. And I said that exactly. I said, what? This can't be right. Here's what Facebook's trying to do. It's actually something trying to prevent people from releasing your nude photos. If you have an instance where somebody has a photo of you and they're going to release it, what you can do in the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and Australia right now, and they're expanding it slowly but surely, you can send that photo to Facebook. And what Facebook will do is they will prevent anyone using image matching from posting that same photo on the network. So it sounds kind of odd. You wouldn't want to send compromising photos of yourself to the world's largest social network, but Facebook says it actually will prevent you from having those photos released by other people. So it's an interesting concept. It's being rolled out right now. I don't know if it's been used by anyone yet or if it's just been tested, but
I don't know. It's
going to be interesting because there's a potential for a lot to go wrong.
And I know. I think that's what I was thinking, you know.
Yeah.
You don't really send those pictures
You know, I think there's a lot of people who are uncomfortable with sending out any kind of uncompromising photos on the internet, let alone sending them to the world's largest social network with 2 billion monthly active users. So it's going to be interesting to see if people do embrace this. I would not be surprised if there are some horror stories that come out of this. Hopefully not. Hopefully it works and is a great new way to prevent this kind of thing from happening. But for now, we'll have to wait and see if anybody sends in their nude photos to Facebook.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And turning now to music news, a rap recording is topping the charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
Today we're talking rap music, which is something that we typically don't discuss, but today we do for very good reason because we find a rap song at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Not for the first week, second week, or third week, but this song has been number one for 4 straight weeks now, so congratulations to rap artist Post Malone on the success he's enjoying with his song Rockstar, which has been doing so well. It's the first song off of his next album. We don't know the title of the album or when it's coming out, but it's off of his next album. And there have been 5 songs to top the rap chart and to top the Hot 100 chart this past year. 5 rap songs, which is kind of amazing. That's not happened before. But not only that, if you look back in history, the longest running rap song at number one on the charts was 6 weeks. So this song has already been number one for 4 weeks. So we're closing in on the record. So we're going to check it out now. Post Malone, this is called Rockstar.
I've been popping, popping, man, I feel just like a rock star. All my brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a rock star.
Is this the biggest hit Post Malone has had?
Well, he's got a couple. I mean, he came out a few years ago with White Iverson, which was a huge hit. It didn't reach number one. He also came out earlier this year with a song called Congratulations. It didn't reach number one. So I guess by that measure, yes, this is his biggest hit. It's only been out for a few weeks, but already number one for 4 weeks, called Rockstar, as I mentioned a little while ago. His real name is Austin Post, and he goes by Post Malone because of Karl Malone, the famous basketball player. Austin used to dream of being a professional basketball player, and his idol was Karl Malone. So he said, I'm going to use my stage name and go by Post Malone. So that's what he's been doing. Very talented guy. His dad worked for the Dallas Cowboys football team in Texas, where Post grew up. He's been known for a different kind of music because he not only combines rap and hip-hop, but there's a little bit of grunge in there. There's some alternative. So he's got a variety of sounds in his music, which kind of sets him apart from the rest of the pack. And he's very well respected. He has a tattoo of President John F. Kennedy on his arm because he thinks that's the best president this country's ever had, and he liked what he stood for, so he went and got a John F. Kennedy tattoo on his arm, which is the only tattoo he's got. But here he is with his number one song, Enjoying Life, and going out on tour.
And who was the artist that had the hit, the rap song, number one for 6 weeks?
Oh, okay, I'm glad you asked. Ray Sremmurd. And the song that they had a hit was called Black Beatles, and that was number one for 6 straight weeks. So now we've got a new number one song this past year, because the song by Ray Sremmurd was out in 2016. So this year, so far, 4 weeks, rock star Post Malone.
So who else was number one in rap this year?
Well, great question, Sarah. We had Cardi B, who's a relative newcomer, and Bodak Yellow, which was number one. In fact, that song knocked Taylor Swift, Look What You Made Me Do, off the number one spot. Kendrick Lamar's Humble. Kendrick Lamar seems to be nominated for every award going this past year, including the upcoming AMAs, the American Music Awards, which are just days away. He's nominated for Artist of the Year and a number of other categories. Migos had a song called Bad and Bougie, and DJ Khaled and Lil Wayne and Chance the Rapper, and there were quite a few of them. So it was a big year for rap music.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I've been popping, popping, man, I feel just like a rock star. Brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a rock star. When we call up on no and show up, man, them the shot toss.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States commends the decision of Massoud Barzani not to seek an additional term as president of the Iraqi Kurdistan region. The U.S. also supports the vote of the Iraqi Kurdistan parliament to distribute presidential authorities to other Kurdish regional government, or KRG, institutions. President Barzani, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, is a historic figure and courageous leader of his people, most recently in our common fight to destroy ISIS. This decision represents an act of statesmanship during a difficult period. The United States now looks forward to engaging actively with the Prime Minister of the Kurdistan Regional Government, Nechirvan Barzani, and the Deputy Prime Minister, Kubad Talabani. A strong Kurdish regional government within a unified and federal Iraq is essential to its long-term stability and to the enduring defeat of ISIS. We call on all Kurdish parties to support the KRG as it works to resolve pending issues over the remainder of its term and prepare for elections in 2018, said Ms. Nauert. The U.S. calls on the government of Iraq and the KRG under its new leadership to resolve pending issues under the Iraqi constitution. We have been encouraged by the security dialogue that has taken place in recent days and call for an end to all confrontations and clashes, said Ms. Nauert. The U.S. also continues to support the strong leadership of Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi as he works to ensure the total defeat of ISIS and a stable Iraq after ISIS. The United States welcomes the recent decision from Prime Minister Abadi to begin a new dialogue with the KRG under the Iraqi constitution and avoid further confrontations. The U.S. will continue to work with all parties as they address these issues for the benefit of all Iraqis. It is time for all parties to look to the future and focus on peaceful resolution of disputes under the Iraqi constitution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.